And get that. There's actually a couple. We have an ask a basket on that table right there, that round table. At the end of every session, feel free to write down any questions you might have for Bob and Gary and put it in that basket. And in between every session, before we start again, I'll check the basket and they'll answer those questions before moving on. And we actually had a couple this morning, so they'll answer those and then get right into it. So help me welcome Bob and Gary.
I'm Gary. I'm out in the hall.
Interesting question. Was I conscious of the phenomenon of craving while it was occurring? No, I didn't figure that out until I was finally clear enough to read the doctor's opinion and see what it was saying there. That I had to put alcohol in. I didn't know the difference between an obsession or craving. An obsession was what was causing me to take the first drink. The first drink was what was causing me to take the rest of the drinks, because the craving had set in and I did. But no, I had. I look back over my first few years in AA and that's it. And I was so dense about what was going on around me, I'm surprised I remember any of it. I didn't know that was a craving. I didn't know anything different. I really didn't know I was alcoholic until I hit that nut house. I don't think everybody else seemed to know it, but somehow it missed me. There were times I actually tried to stop drinking, I knew things would go a lot easier at home had I stopped drinking. Just didn't hit it, you know. Julie would be so upset at me, and I would promise her with everything in my bones that I wouldn't take a drink. I'm not going to take a drink today. I really couldn't. And then find myself at D.T. Johnson's. D.T. Johnson's was a bar there, and it had a pink elephant on the downside. And I'd find me in there before noon drinking again. You wake up knowing something ain't right. You look at the people you're around, and they're getting up, and they seem to be functioning real well on the outside. I knew I couldn't function that good on the outside just because the way I felt on the inside. I wasn't conscious of much at all about that.
Good morning. I didn't know it was called craving, but I knew about it. I knew that the way I responded to taking a drink wasn't normal. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to change that behavior because I was unable to. So I was aware of craving, I just didn't know that's what it was called. But when I took a drink, it was like bar the door. And worse than that, and I actually had the same thing that my father had, and that was that I had a radical personality change when I drank. And if you think that my personality is bad right now, you ought to see me with a couple of shots at me. So I didn't know what it was called, but I was well aware of its effect. This says, where did you poke around to find out about the thing called spirituality? I'll tell you just a brief story. They took me to a halfway house for drunks not to live, but to meet the guy that ran it, who was this 300 and some pound priest. And I got to know him pretty well. He was just a really, really nice guy. And thank you. And he asked me if I like to fish, and I do. And so we were right next to a 741 square mile lake. huge lake, one of the biggest inland lakes in the country, called Lake Winnebago. And so he said, well, let's go fishing. And I said, all right. So he had a boat and an outboard motor, and we'd go, you know, he'd say, so what do you think about God, Bob? And I'd go, I don't. And he'd go, you really ought to think about that, because that's the only thing that's saving your sorry ass at this point. And so we'd go out and fish for a white bass and walleyes in the middle of that lake. So what he'd do is he'd go out into the middle of Lake Winnebago, which is a huge lake, and then he'd start asking me about God again. Where are you going to go? And, you know, God bless him for doing it. And he made me consider that there was a God. It was hard to argue with him because things changed and I didn't know why. And all of a sudden there was an effect in my life that was not there before. And other guys in AA would, they go, you really have to do, you know, get used to this idea that you're going to be praying and talking to God and all that stuff. And I mean, I was set against it. And they would keep encouraging me to change my mind. A huge portion of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous is changing your mind. And I have virtually had to change my mind about almost everything. There was a guy in Denver called Frank McGibbon that was, he was a guy that got drafted by the New York Giants football team. 6'6", 325 pounds, and an attorney, for God's sake. And combative as hell, and ran a group there. And we were having a discussion, and he said, now listen to me. And I said, what's up? And he said, I'm going to tell you something you need to know. And I went, all right. And he said, about the time that you really start believing that something is the absolute truth, you're going to get it shoved right up your ass. He was given to making those kinds of statements. And what I found out was the only complete truth that I know is God is. I am absolutely certain of that. So I had a spiritual awakening that the book calls the educational variety. Once you get enough compelling information, it's hard not to believe. And that's how I found spirituality. Thanks.
I wasn't so much a disbeliever. It just had never come up as a subject of discussion that I recalled when I came in here and we're reading the book and we're talking about God. I think it's more was experiential for me. I said last night that I came to believe a little bit because I'd watch other people come into AA and get their lives together. And they blamed it on this experience with God. And I don't know that I really spent a lot of time thinking about it. I went through a period where I was convinced that God was some kind of spiritual bellhop. And you know how that worked out. And but that was kind of my starting place for it. I probably learned more about this. It wasn't from reading books or the Bible or that, but we had our fellowship in the young people's group, but we also touched with a bunch of Frank's guys. Berger and
yeah.
Berger was an ex-priest, as I remember.
He was.
And these guys, and these guys had some experience that made sense when you talked to them. Even Frank did. He scared a lot of people, and part of my, I'm glad to tell that now. But he scared a lot of people, but hanging around with some of those guys and hearing them talk, they were sharing their experience. They weren't preaching something to me. They weren't telling me what was going to happen if I didn't do something. Well, they would. They'd tell me I could go out there and die a horrible death. But those things were kind of going on for us. We found our way through doing at our little workshop when the young people's group started to go through the book and the stuff together as literally and anal as we could. I was kind of have a spiritual experience, and I learned some things. Part of the reason I think we do this is in hope some of you will become better sponsors with it and learn to use the book and the steps to help other people get sober. And you can see some profound changes in the people you're working with. But I remember, and I opened my book to this because I don't memorize as well as I used to. But on page 53, mine's the third edition. I don't know where it is in the form. I started changing some things when I read the book. This is not an attempt to rewrite the book, but I would read something in there, and if it kind of touched on me, I'd switch it to first person. Bill always wrote in the third person, or we, or us, or our. And so when I came across this line, it says, when I became alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis I could not postpone or evade, I had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was my choice to be? And that was an easy question. That was fun. And that was an easy question. It was okay. I get it. Something I got it done. We did the. We came out of this in the second step, as I remembered, and I had come to believe. I was willing to take it. I don't know that I ever really argued about it with anybody, but I was always listening, and I became more and more open to this business of God in our lives, some kind of spirit that was going to do that. And to this day, I've never tried to define it. I've never tried to build my own concept. I just know I'm living in the love that's beyond anything I ever heard of or dreamed of or anything else, and that seems to continue. We one night, we may talk about it some more and all that, but one night we decided as a group to take the third step together. And we were down to 14 men. We started out in a bigger group than that, but a bunch of them had disappeared. We were down to 14 guys. And one of us explained that we ought to join hands and read/pray the third step together. And I don't know how Bob felt about that, but I was a little goosey about it. I wasn't used to being in a room full of boys holding hands. Nor was I used to being seen praying. That was something where, I think somewhere in the New Testament, we're told to go into our prayer closet and shut the door and pray. So that's That was fine with me. I didn't want to be seen doing it. But we did it, and we said the third step prayer together. And three or four things happened immediately after that, that were pretty profound for me. That night, when I left that meeting and was going home, I said another prayer. Because I think, felt that I had been saying that prayer, holding hands with all of us, because everybody else was doing it. And so I, just to cover my backside, I said another prayer on the way home. And I said, God, make it real. I can't stand living like this much longer. This is just too damn painful. And I'm in. Later on, after that, I attended a meeting that I hadn't normally gone to. And it was down in Old Littleton. And I walked in there, and it was an early meeting. I had made a deal with my wife that night that I wanted to go to a meeting, and she wanted to go to her Al-Anon meeting. Her Al-Anon meeting started at the same hour the one I was attending was over. And so she was going to tuck the kids into bed and take off, and I would show up back home 5 or 10 minutes later to babysit the girls. By the time that it worked out. But I went to this meeting. And I can't tell you anything about the meeting, but I can tell you it was over. I'm sitting next to Big Frank. And he was really intimidating. And he used it. Sometimes he used it well, but sometimes he used it just for fun. And I'm sitting next to him at the meeting. And then after the meeting, I just sat down together. It was unspoken. We just sat right back down there. Everybody left the room. And I says, Frank, I said, I just discovered something. And he looked at me. I said, you don't scare me one damn bit anymore, you big son of a bitch. You just... And he laughed like crazy and hugged me, and I thought I was going to die. Who just said that? And I left the meeting and was headed home to meet the girls. And I had the sensation that my butt hadn't hit the chair in the car, hadn't hit the seat. And I get to the house, and our youngest daughter's bedroom was downstairs, and I went in to kiss her goodnight, and she was already asleep. Kissed her anyway. What a concept. Went upstairs, and my oldest daughter was awake up there, and so Carrie and I visited for a minute, and I kissed her goodnight, and then I went in Patty's room, and she was in there crying. And she was crying because she had a bellyache, and she had been diagnosed with ulcers at a very young age. And I offered to go down and get her some milk, and she took the offer. And I brought it upstairs, and we're drinking that and sitting there talking, and I had a flashback. I had gone to work for a company I had taken this job with this company, and it was doing something I had never in my life dreamed of doing for making a living. It just never entered my mind. And I probably wouldn't have taken it if I had known that these people were fairly religious people, and they started every morning off working, praying, and all this. And they talked about the results of prayer, and it kind of made me a little squirmy and that. But I know they believed it, and I knew they did it. And so I'm sitting there talking to Patty, and her belly hurts. And I said, do you want to pray about your tummy? Should we talk to God about that? And she said, yeah, I would like that, Daddy. So I held her one hand here. I put my other hand on her stomach, and I said a prayer. I have no idea what I said. What I said had nothing to do with it. But I said the prayer. When I opened my eyes and looked down at Patty, she was asleep. And I went downstairs and sat down in the chair, although I didn't feel like I was sitting in the chair, and enjoyed the moment. And I don't know how long it was. Looking back on it, I kind of wish it was still going on. Seriously, I don't know. It was great. And a few months later, back during that time, the Mexican food had really started hitting Denver in a big way. And we loved green chili, still do, and that we made and that still make, and these things. And everybody's coming home from school, and me from work, and walking. And the house just smelled wonderful. When that stuff's cooking, it's intoxicating. It's just a wonderful smell. Walk in the house, and I knew what we were having right away. And the oldest girl says, "Well, what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that." She says, "I can too. My belly hadn't hurt for a long time." Now, you can do what you want with that, but that kid is 50, what, 3, 4, 5 years old. I hadn't heard a complaint about a belly ache yet. That was an immediate result of me having gone through those steps. Now, I think all my experience up until that point had a big thing to do with it. I gave you a little hint that I have found so helpful about when reading in the big book. Put it in first person for you. It takes on a little more oomph, as I see it, to help me to understand it. At the end of the first, fourth, and fifth chapter, it says, being convinced we were at step three, I just changed it there. Being convinced I was at step three. Which I decided to turn my will and my life over to God as I understood it. Just what do I mean by that? Just what do I do? The first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Take that and try it. Try it when you're sitting down with you're working with somebody and taking them to do it. Let's read it this way. You'll get so you can do it as easily as you can read it the way it's written. But it helps me a lot when I do that. So that's kind of a suggestion I'd throw out to you. It also, I think, clears it up. Because when I was reading this, there were lots of places in it where I didn't really grasp what Bill was saying as well as I could. And so when I started doing that, I seemed to have less and less of that problem. Just throw that out. That's my comment about that. I have tried about anything I know to try other than becoming a Hindu and worshiping cows in terms of looking at the spiritual life. I guess I have read the Upanishads, so I'm sorry. And I took what I seemed to be taking that seemed to fit in what was going on in my life was my relationship with God. And the rest has kind of gone away. The only thing I've really taken is literally and made sure was in my life is in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And I haven't changed that from that. I find a great deal of help today by learning to sit and listen. And I really wish I'd had this back when I was learning this, but I didn't get it. But my concept of God, if you will, is that, and I said it earlier, based on my experience, drunk and sober, as a lousy husband sober, practicing everything I shouldn't be doing, sober as well as drunk, and that sort of thing, is that I was loved just as much when I was in the middle of my very worst behavior as I am today if I'm on my very best behavior. That God's love has never changed. It never has. And he must have the fastest forgetter and forgiver of him. I mean, it's quick. It's over right now. When I recognize what's going on. It's just that simple. So that's a short version of what's gone on. I've thrown big books, thrown Bibles, dumped it all. It's all part of the deal. Didn't hurt me a bit. So this is, I'm just throwing this out. We got the adventure right in front of us we're going to get back to here in the 12 steps. But I think second and third step were huge to me. When we, Bob touched on it last night, when we said that third step prayer together, Eddie went out and got drunk and froze to death. Eddie had a wooden leg. And very often he'd go back out and get drunk and lose his leg, and then a carload of buses would run all over Denver trying to find that damn leg. That time we didn't look for him. But those of us who finished it, either died sober or are still sober, and I think we've left a little trail behind us that's worthwhile so far. Bob and I were talking earlier this morning. I fell in love with this outfit, this whole deal of Alcoholics Anonymous, the part I criticize as well as the part I love, and love to be in the middle of it. I love to be in the middle of all of it. That back when we were doing that second and third step, I think right in there in that area is where all of a sudden it changed for me. And this deal was what I wanted to do the rest of my life, so I pretty much have.
I'd like to share with you my experience with doing third steps. Now, I had mentioned before that we try and go back through all 12 steps on a regular basis. So the first time I went through the third step, which was in preparation for what Gary was talking about when we all got on our knees and said the prayer, Don said, read that prayer to me. And I said, okay. And the part in the beginning, it says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. And he said, what's that mean? And I said, what it looks like to me is that I'm giving God a blank check about what he does with me. And that I somehow am agreeing that God can make me into whatever he has in mind. You know, the relieve me of the bondage itself, that I may better do thy will, is all right because it sounds like something positive. And then it becomes even more positive when it says, take away my difficulties, but then it explains why, which sort of takes some of the fun out of it. Because it says that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, which means that I'm going to be an example. Well, you know, all that... May I do thy will always. I'm looking at that and going, what's he got in mind? My problem isn't whether God is or he isn't. My problem is, what is he up to? And one of the things that we do is just normal human beings, is we will attribute to God the same ideas that we have. And see, I got kind of a crooked mind. So I'm thinking, what if he wants to play a joke? You know, what if he wants me to wear a robe and a rope and stand on a corner in Nairobi and hand out religious tracts? And my mind will, we have, as drunks, we have this inclination to catastrophize. We can look at a whole bunch of really simple, ordinary circumstances and turn it into World War III. And that's just normal alcoholic behavior, incidentally, so don't be surprised. And it just So I'm looking at this deal, and the mistake that Don made was that he went over this a week before we were going to say the prayer. He said, I want you to think about it for a week. If I think about anything for a week, so when we got together in Levy's basement to do the prayer, he said, do you want to do this? And I said, no. And he said, then I can't help you. And I said, you don't understand. You asked me if I wanted to do it. I don't want to do it, but I will do it. And so we all got on our knees and said the prayer. And he said, why were you so afraid to do that? And I said, I don't want to give God that kind of power in my life. And he laughed and he said, God's got all the power anyway. You know, this is just an exercise in who's God and who's the drunk. So, I went into my first third step agreeing to it reluctantly and afraid of the consequences. Here's the challenge. The challenge is, what if there really is a God? And what if he's really serious about this? What's he going to do? And, you know, I've been doing the same thing for a long time, and I got to tell you, without the fear. And God's never done anything to me that I wouldn't agree to. So what do I do today? Back, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 years ago, I was going through the steps again and got to the third step. And when the book describes the third step, it describes it as giving ourselves entirely to him. And so I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, wonder what that looks like. And so I made a decision that in the third step and the seventh step, which are both turning points in this program, that I would virtually put everything on the altar. That includes my life. That includes everything I have. That includes everything. And that when I turn to God in the third step and the seventh step, that I would say, take everything, leave everything, do what you want, kill me. I'm ready to leave everything up to you, everything. No exceptions. Now what? That's an interesting experiment, and I would encourage you to do it, to see what happens, because most of us, as I said, will attribute our own personalities to God, and then we'll expect him to act like we would act, which is just crazy thinking. So I went in and continue to go into that step, putting everything on the altar. The net result of it is that my life has continued to improve. You might. There's an old expression around Denver AA, and it was around when Gary and I were in Young People's. And that is the hardest thing about trusting God is trusting God. And if you want to put that on the line, put everything on the altar. See how much courage you have to trust God. See if God doesn't have something back there just to make your life a little more miserable. There isn't anything. So that's what I do in the third step today, is just go, you know what, I'm 78 years old. If God killed me today, I've had a hell of a life. I have had more than my share of everything. Everything. And God has been extremely generous with me, and if he wanted to yank the rug right now, I'm up for it, as long as it's God's will. I should have been dead 43 years ago. And I have gotten to live an incredible life. And one of the most pleasant experiences that I have is just like this. Just sitting here saying, there is a God. He loves you more than you would believe. And he wants you to be engaged in your life, and he has something in mind for you. And our job is to find out what that is and then go out and do it. And it probably has something to do with making someone else's life better. So if you want a good exercise about trusting God, put everything on the altar and see what happens to you. If you have the courage.
Love it when you talk about that. So selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And that's more true today with 51 years sobriety in my mind than it was when I first got here. Because I was really a nice guy, you guys just you didn't understand that. It's not really all about me. What I've been doing lately, well, let me selfishness, self-centeredness, that I think is the root of my trouble. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt me, seemingly without provocation, but I invariably find that at some time in the past I've made a decision based on self, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. So my troubles, I think, are basically of my own making. They arouse out of myself, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-willed lying, though I usually don't think so. Of everything, I must be rid of this selfishness. I must or kill me. God makes that possible, not to kill me, but he, or you don't want something. And there often sees no way of getting entirely rid of self without his aid. I had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I could not live up to them, even though I would have liked to. Neither could I reduce my self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on my own norma. I had to have God's help. Now, I think you can wrap those two paragraphs up I just read into one little simple statement. If I'm not the problem, there ain't no answer. Yeah. No matter who I thought was the cause of all my issues, it wasn't him. It really is all about me. I sometimes look at the following pages around the third step, and I wonder, and I don't have an answer to this, but I wonder why God wrote it the way he did. Or why God, well, why I build it with that. He tells us his concepts of God. God's a principal and his agent. He's the Father and his Son. But then he goes into the third step promises list there. He tells us that first. And we get through that, and then he tells us the prayer. Then after that, he tells us we probably should take that prayer with somebody else after we've already done it. I'm not sure why it is. It works that way, but it seems like it was. I think. It's this one. I sincerely took such a position. Either I understand God's God and I'm not. All sorts of remarkable things follows. I had a new employer. Being all powerful, he provided me with. Provided what I needed if I kept close to him and performed his work well. One, established on such footing, I became less and less interested in myself, my little plans and designs. That's the first promise. Two, more and more, I became interested in seeing what I could contribute to life as I felt new powerful wind. Three, as I enjoyed peace of mind. Four, as I discovered I could face life successfully. As I became conscious of his presence. Five, I began to lose my fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. I was reborn with that. So that's what he tells us before we say the prayer. And then there's the prayer. And the idea that we ought to do it with somebody else. And he also tells us to voice it, to say it out loud. I don't know why. What I'm thinking here is maybe we ought to say the prayer together, if you'd like to do that. And the way we're located here, maybe we could. But you can sit there and do it there. And those of you who don't know it, grab a big book and you're welcome to read it. Or you can all get down on your knees and do whatever you think with it, if it's your calling. Awful hard for me to get up or down.
Poor old man.
He's setting himself up because he's a lot older than I am. Okay, are we ready? God,
I offer myself to thee to build with me. To do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of bondage to self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them, may bear witness to those I would help, thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always.
Gosh, nobody said amen.
Isn't that great?
It really is.
Well, because there is no amen. It's on the end of the seventh step.
So I think that presumes we're in prayer through the next few steps, but he's not. Point for you, Bob.
Let's talk about inventory. you're ready, unless you have
simple hands.
So the book says that we start the inventory process with resentments. And it says resentments is the number one offender and that it kills more alcoholics than anything else. So I suspect we ought to be paying attention. And it says that we inventory people, institutions, and principles. And almost everyone who does inventory. And this is where a lot of people stop. They get to this and they either don't know how to do it or they're afraid to do it. for a variety of reasons, one of which they're terrified about who they're going to find in there. And, you know, they think that there's a green monster in the middle of it and they don't want to see it. So almost everyone who writes inventory will inventory people. A smaller percentage of people who write inventory will inventory institutions. And an even smaller group of people, when they write inventory, will inventory principles. So we'll explain what we do. And first of all, we'll just talk about resentments and those three things that the book suggests we do. And then we can talk about fear afterwards, and we can talk about sex after that. It's set up basically depending upon who you talk to. God, there is a divergent line there where all sorts of people go in different directions. But I will tell you that we try and do it as closely to the way it's written as we can. And if you do that, you're going to wind up with four columns. I've seen people write three columns. I've seen people write eight columns. I've seen them write all kinds of things, but I don't know where they find that stuff. And some of them will go get a Hazelden guide, and some people... There is a proliferation at this point in Alcoholics Anonymous of things that are called workbooks. I'll give you an opinion, which means please don't think there's more than a grain of truth at that in what I believe, but I think that workbooks are a travesty. And if you can't read a sixth grade book and do what it says, you probably need more help than you're going to get in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I think there ought to be a public burning. Well, tough shit. That's the way I feel. If we needed extra help, I think it would have been in here. And there are legions of us that somehow managed to survive for all these years because all we did was follow what's written in this book. So, you know, do what you want to do. Here's the deal. It's your life. Okay? And if you want to enhance your ability to live a better life, I'm inclined to stay in here. And some other drunk giving me directions, if they aren't in here, it becomes questionable. So even though there are people who are well-meaning who write workbooks because they think we're too goddamn stupid to read this, am I making a point here? Well, so I have strong opinions, you may have noticed. And you know why? Because it's my experience. And you get to do what you want, clearly. And whatever your... One of the most powerful things that we gain in Alcoholics Anonymous is something called intuitive thought. And so listen to that. And if it takes you down a different path, don't be embarrassed. You know, we have all wandered down different paths. But listen to your intuition. And it will tell you, there are two voices in your head. One of them is the intuition and the other one's the ego. And the intuition is a small, quiet, confident voice. And the ego is a loud, brash thing that will lie to you. And if you want to read an interesting book, there's a book that was written by Eckhart Tolle called A New Earth. And it's a book entirely about the ego. And he agrees with everything that Bill Wilson said. And that is that the ego is the enemy. And the thing about the ego is that it never tells you the truth. It always tells you that you're less than what you are, no matter what you think. It will always lie. It never, ever, ever tells the truth. And it is never satisfied. So it'll tell you, I remember when mine told me I needed a new Corvette. And I went and bought it. And the next day I'm sitting there going, what did I just do? And see, I thought that a new car, and what my ego told me was, boy, the ladies are really going to like this. You know, there were no women running up to the door saying, let me in, because I want to get friendly. And see, the other thing about the ego is that it's never satisfied. So I got this new Corvette, and the ego's going, well, that's nice, but maybe you ought to buy an Armani suit. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing the game. Okay? Well, do you know you can talk to your ego? You really can. And so if your ego, see, because what a drunk's ego will tell them is, you're a failure. You're stupid. You'll never amount to anything. Nobody likes you. You're going to have to go get a whole bunch of stuff just to get even. I mean, just so you're up on a plane with everybody else, because you're starting from way back. What you can tell about those kind of comments in your head is that they're all lies. Every one of them. And we are all a child of God. And the idea that we are substandard, second-class citizens, damaged goods, or whatever the hell it is a lie. You are no more damaged goods than I am, and I am not damaged. So I'm going to write down, when you do people, you put their name in the first column. Second column says the cause. So then you ask why you're angry with them. It says it's a grudge list. So why do you have a grudge? What'd they do to you? You put that in the second column, but Don was real fond of telling me that if I had more than six words in the second column, I was overstating my case. In the third column, it says what it affects. And then it lists these: self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations, and on the end of its pocketbook. But I put that under financial security just because that's what I do, and you get to do whatever you want. And then on the next page, it talks about referring to our list again. And it asks, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? And for us, that's the fourth column. Where were we to blame? Um, So it's nothing more than answering the questions. Now, the first time I wrote inventory, I just wrote down self-esteem, security, ambitions, personal relations, sex relations, and that's all that I wrote in that column. And then when I went to Fifth Step with Don, I couldn't remember why I wrote that. So what I started doing is I started writing self-esteem because. And then I would put a short explanation behind the word. And that just helped me to explain why I wrote that. The definitions of those words can get far afield. Self-esteem means, how does it make you feel about yourself? And, we write inventory in the simplest terms possible. So my self-esteem is how I think about myself. Security, what do I want to be secure in? There can be all kinds of things. A relationship, a job, money. There's all kinds of things I want to be secure in. So I don't write pocketbook. I write financial security. Ambitions. My ambitions are what I want or who I want to be. That pretty much covers all my ambitions. And what you write about is why are those things hurt, threatened, or interfered with. Personal relations, how does it affect other people in general? Sex relations, how does it affect an intimate relationship? And that's it for the way I write. And then it says, where was I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or frightened? What's selfish? Well, depends on who you talk to, I suppose. Selfish for me is it's mine and you can't have it. Dishonest means there's a lie sitting in the middle of it somewhere. Self-seeking means I don't care whose it is, I'm taking it. Okay? And frightened is self-explanatory. It's about fear. Do you know almost everything in Alcoholics Anonymous has to do with self-centered fear? So where was I to blame? That can be God knows what. I mean, that's all over the place. So you shouldn't have a problem answering that question, because blame has to do with what did I do in the middle of this to cause it or continue it or whatever it is. And that's about people. Institutions can be schools, can be the courts, can be, yeah, the church, oh my. And any form of institution. And some of us can be very, I've never been a big institution person. I mean, they just don't piss me off. I don't think they got that kind of power, except the courts. which had me right by the tail. When I was just coming out of high school. So in the police, it just they really didn't like what I was up to most of the time. Do you know, in the town that I lived in, every time somebody broke into a store or knocked out a window or whatever, they came right to my house. They went, "You did it, didn't you?" And I'd go, "No, I didn't." And so I was number one on their hit parade. And it started to make me think that for some reason I was going to be a gangster. And I was right. So, you know, I can't tell you how much bad information we'll accept as fact and then carry it around for the rest of our lives. And that, if you have the courage to do this stuff, it's going to give you insight that is way above the normal person. Because you'll see things, and then you'll start seeing them in others, and it'll just make you sick. There are times when I don't even want to go to AA meetings, because I'll hear people talk about themselves, and you'll see some bright, articulate person, and they'll start describing themselves in the most demeaning terms. And you don't have to, you know, people, if they're talking, they're talking about themselves. Well, it isn't, I suppose it is selfish, but it's, but that's what people talk about. Even if they're talking about you, they're talking about them. So, and you'll hear them talk about themselves, and you'll go, "Whoa, disconnect." And you'll see this person, and see, your intuition will tell you who they are. And then they'll start describing themselves, and it isn't anything like what you see. And you'll know they're confused, and that they have bad information, and that they bought it. And they may spend the rest of their lives believing it. And there is nothing worse, in my estimation, than watching a person spending the rest of their life thinking they're worthless. Well, you can get it, all that stuff. So institutions, yeah, that's pretty straightforward. Are we, do you need a break?
I want you to do principles afterward.
Okay.
Well, take a break. He'll talk about principles when we get back, and you need to hear it.
I don't know.